Rick, that was pretty. Appreciate that. And good afternoon. Seems like I'm closer to everybody. You moved the lectern up, didn't you? No more spitting while I'm talking then, I guess. Okay. Well, last time when I was speaking, we talked about coming out of Babylon and how this command applied to the early church when it was written, when the book of Revelation was written, and how we might also follow it today. We also took a quick look at how different groups, even here in our own local area here in Pennsylvania, have come to very different conclusions as to how they could follow that advice and come out of the world. So it was interesting to look at that and realize some of the scriptural principles involved. Well, today I'd like to turn the clock back about 2,000 years and look at Jewish society in Palestine during the time of the Roman Empire now, the very beginnings of the Roman Empire after the Roman Republic. And the Jewish society, I'm talking about Judea and Galilee, where Jesus was from. And this was be at the time of Jesus. Excuse me. And these are the people that were God's covenant people at that time. How did they apply their old scriptures, what we call the Old Testament, how did they apply their scriptures to their modern times? Did Jesus have anything to say about that and how they did it and how they separated themselves? And what did Jesus and his disciples do? How did they behave? What was their approach to this? And can this information, once we look at it, can this information help us to better understand perhaps a few scriptures? And the answer to that is yes, we'll see. And finally, I'd like you to keep this in the back of your mind the whole time we're talking about this. How does any of this that we're going through have an application to us today? What are the practical applications of this information for the 21st century for those of us that are following God at this time? So keep that in the back of your mind. Think of applications, because I'm going to ask you to tell me what you've come up with when we get further on into the sermon. Excuse me. Now, first, I need to mention that I could have started in earlier times. We could have gone back to ancient Israel, who were told not to copy the practices of their neighbors. We could go back to Esther, the time of the Persian Empire, when they were threatened with, the Jews were threatened with extinction, with being eradicated by their neighbors. We could go back to Daniel, or we could go back to the prophets, the 7th and 8th century BC prophets, that prophesied to Israel and to Judah, and constantly said, identifying the sins of the people and why they were going to go through what they went through, or why they were going through it in some cases. We could go back to Ezra and Nehemiah, perhaps, and they reestablished the worship of Yahweh, and of course there were things that happened then where they told people to get rid of their the wives that they shouldn't have taken, and so on. We could go back to any of those times, but what I've decided is just to go back to the time of Jesus, the time of the Jews in their own homeland. They were there in Judea, and they were under the authority of the Roman Empire. This is entirely different, and we got to realize this when we get started here. Being in Jerusalem or in Judea, or in Galilee even, was entirely different than being a Jew in Alexandria, or Babylon, or Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamos, Corinth, any of those places, or Rome. In the diaspora, it was very different, and I want to talk about that in a future sermon, but today I want to stick with the Jews that lived in their own homeland, because it was different in their own homeland. Ever since the days of Julius Caesar, but especially with the one that came after him, Octavian or Augustus Caesar, the Jews were had been given special exemptions, special exceptions, special privileges within the Roman Empire. Augustus was very good friends with Herod. Herod's sons were all educated in Rome, so there was this bond between Augustus and Herod. Augustus and his wife even donated to some cause right there in Jerusalem, in the area. I don't know if it was in Jerusalem. I tried to look it up, and I couldn't find it. I wanted to tell you exactly what it was. But they donated to the Jews. This is the ruler of the modern Western world in that time, the Roman Empire, Augustus. He was friends with the Jews. And they had exemptions. If they were supposed to go to court on a Friday afternoon, they could get an exemption because they had to be home and get ready for the Sabbath. So the Jews had privileges in the Roman Empire, especially under Augustus. Now, that all changed after Augustus' time, but that's the way it was. And we need to keep that in mind, And especially in Judea, it was different because the whole society revolved around the Bible that they had, the Torah, and their interpretations of it, and that's how they lived their lives. So you got to understand that going in. But their lives were, you know, they had that day-to-day life. I've talked about women in the time of Jesus. I've talked about children in the time of Jesus. Now I'm pretty much going to talk about everybody. You know, what types of things, and I'm going to focus on just a couple, what things did they have to deal with day in and day out? And what they had to deal with in Jerusalem or in Judea or in Galilee was very different than what Jews in the rest of the empire had to deal with, and we'll talk about that at a different time. Now, I use several resources, but the one I'm going to quote from today is called Stone and Dung, Oil and Spit. That's really a nice title, right? It's by Jody Magnus. She's an archaeologist. And so her insight, some of which I'm going to be quoting, her insight's based on things that she's dug up or other people have dug up that she's analyzed. I just didn't have time. I had a very, very busy week and I didn't have time, but I wanted to make this a PowerPoint and actually show you some of the things that, you know, they have pictures in the book, but not going to do you any good where you're sitting. Some of the things that they've dug up that that shed light on the issues that I'm going to talk about. But Jody is an archaeologist, and I think she's got some interesting insight. And her specialty is Qumran, where the Essenes were. They were out away from Jerusalem, these people that were very conservative and were opposed to the Jerusalem establishment, so opposed that they decided to go out and live as hermits in their own little compound and have their own rules and laws. And when they discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls, they found out a lot about this group out there. That's where the majority of her research is. And she began to write a book about that and ended up being more of a book of daily life in the time of Jesus. So she changed it to that, and that's what this particular book's about. Okay, I want to give some a little more background. Before we get into that, there are three factors that we ought to consider. And one I've already mentioned, Judea and Galilee to a lesser degree, but pretty also, were mostly a Jewish society. Yes, they were ruled by the Romans. Yes, it was part of the Roman Empire. Yes, there was eventually a Roman governor. At first there were Herods, and then there was a Roman governor. Pilate, it was the one that was there when Jesus was killed, of course. But it wasn't a Roman society, it was a Jewish society, and the Romans tolerated it, as long as the Jews didn't get too far out of line. It made it possible for them to practice their religion in the Roman Empire, free of persecution at this time. Now, again, that changed. And it was due largely to the friendship between Octavian and Herod. Now, secondly, we ought to remember also that Israel, turn to Exodus chapter 19. Exodus chapter 19. Israel was expected. They expected themselves to be in a state of purity when they approached God. And if you know, when they were going to receive the 10 words, the 10 commandments, it's written in Exodus chapter 19, beginning in verse 6. I got the King James up here with me today. It says, "You shall be unto me as a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel." And then if we skip down to verses 10 and 11, it says, "And the Eternal said to Moses, go to the people and sanctify them," that is, set them apart, right? "Sanctify them today and tomorrow. Let them wash their clothes. Let them be ready against the third day, for on the third day the Lord will come down in the sight of all the people upon Mount Sinai." So this is an introduction, you might say, to how the people are going to have to behave when they approach God. And they're going to have to wash themselves. They're going to have to get ready. They're going to have to be sanctified. And this is something that's in the mentality of the Israelites throughout their history. In Leviticus, we'll skip down to Leviticus chapter 11, and it talks about different types of foods, the foods that were to be eaten or not eaten and so forth. In verse 4, Leviticus 11 and verse 4 says, "Don't eat of them." Oh, do I want to turn there now? Yeah, I guess I can. 11 chapter chapter 11 and verse 4. Of them that shall you not eat of them that chew the cud, nor of them that divide the hoof. The camel, for instance, because he chews his cud but divides not the hoof, is to be unclean. I'm going to come back. I wanted to read that now because we're going to mention that later. But while we're here, we'll go ahead and read that. But chapter 11, verse 44. 11, verse 44. For I am the Lord your God, you shall therefore sanctify yourselves, and you shall be holy, for I am holy. Neither shall you defile yourselves with any manner of creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. We're going to come to that again, too. Verse 45. For I am the Lord that brings you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy. And I can read, you can write it down. I won't turn there. Chapter 19 and verse 2. Chapter 20, of this is the Leviticus, verses 7 and 8 and verse 26. They all mention, look, I am holy. Yahweh says, you are to be holy because you're my people. So this is part of the mentality of the Israelites, that they are to be holy. And to them, it's meant to be in a state of purity when they approached God. Now, there were lots of things, and it's not my purpose to go into all of these things, but we will go into several. There were lots of things that made you impure. You could have some kind of a disease in your skin. You could have touched somebody who died or was already dead. You had to carry a body or something like that. You could touch a dead animal. There are all kinds of things we could go into. Just certain natural things that happened to you that made you unclean. Uncleanness was not a sin. It was just meant you were ritually impure. And as such, the way they understood it, they shouldn't approach the tabernacle, for instance, or go on the temple grounds or something like that. The solution, the remedy for being impure was usually some kind of a washing, usually an immersion, actually, where they, you know, like a baptism, they'd go under the water, and they'd have to wait until a certain period of time. Oftentimes, it was just till sundown. So this is the idea of being unclean. We're not talking about sin here. Sin defiles as well, but that's not the point here. The point here is ritual purity. You have been in contact with something that's impure, therefore you're impure and you shouldn't approach God. That's something we read about in the Old Testament. It was in their scriptures. And they had this as part of their heritage. And so in the day of Jesus, they wanted to apply these scriptures to their lives in the Roman Empire in the first century. And they did that. And it shouldn't be surprising because the more things change, the more they stay the same. What you find is that they had as many different opinions as to how they were to do that as the Amish and the Mennonites do about how they're to come out of the world that we talked about last time. There's all these different degrees of separation, degrees of what you should do. And that's the way it was in the time of Jesus. and one of the questions was, and this is one of the things they debated, was the purity that was required of the priests, and we're not going to go into all of that, but there were certain things that the priests had to do in the Old Testament. I'm going to turn to one scripture eventually. They had these ritual washings. And they thought, well, if the priests had to be that way and we're all holy, then maybe we should all be holy like that, and maybe we should all go have these washings. And that was part of the debate. Some people said yes, some people said no. Some people said something in between. Some people said, well, only in Jerusalem. That's the holy place. That's where God's temple is. Some people said all of the land of Israel. Some people said only on the Temple Mount. There you have to be pure. So there's all these back and forth. The people that lived out in where the Essenes lived out in Qumran, and they had their own little compound out in the desert, they applied the rules that the Israelites had in their wanderings, you know, where they had to go outside the camp to relieve themselves and all this kind of stuff. They did those kind of things. They treated it as a camp. And in their view, although they had taken themselves out of society, in their view, Jerusalem, all of Jerusalem, was kind of like the camp of Israel. And therefore, there should be no chickens in the camp of Israel that are going to mess around, you know, leave a mess on the ground. There should be no dogs in the camp. They didn't think there should be any chickens or any dogs in Jerusalem. They had all these ideas about how Jerusalem should be. And they, you know, since it wasn't that way, they just separated themselves and lived out in the desert. So you had all of these different ideas about how to be pure, how to be God's people, how to be holy because God is holy. And again, that shouldn't surprise us because it's always been that way. We come up to different conclusions. So, yes, it was a Jewish society, and yes, they felt to one degree or another, that they had to be pure to approach God. They didn't agree on how that should be. The other thing that we need to keep in the background as we go through this is to understand that social status in Jewish society wasn't figured the same way it was in the rest of the Roman Empire. Anybody tell me? Anybody up on their history? How was social status derived in the Roman Empire? Now, there's more than one answer to this. But what kind of a system did society operate by in the Rome? You know, in Rome, if you were in Rome. Anybody know? If you were a regular Joe, how did you function? Well, you functioned down, yeah, but you latched on to somebody. The system is called, in our modern terminology, a patron-client system. You had your people who were somebody and who had money and had land and had possessions and had connections, and you had the rest of us that didn't have that. And if you didn't have that, you somehow or another were connected to somebody who did. And they would be a mentor or, you know, a patron is what it was, you know, the term. That's the way it was in most of the Roman Empire. That's not the way it was in Jerusalem, in Judea, in Galilee. The Jews didn't operate that way. For what it's worth, or for better or for worse, I guess I should say. I won't tell you how they operated yet. Well, yes, I will. It was based on religion. It was based on religion. It's what sect you were part of or how you were connected to the temple. You had your well-off people. In general, they were connected with the Sadducees, they were connected with temple worship, and they had compromised with the Romans to have the goods that they had. And they lived well. And Jody, in her book here, talks about how they've excavated these areas where there are rich people's houses close to the temple precincts. These people, how can they tell they're rich? Well, what do you think? What do you think you could say? If you're digging up, how could you tell that somebody was well off if you were digging up a house that's 2,000 years old? What would you look for? Size. Or what do you think you would find?
Size,
okay. This one. Houses are larger than normal. What else?
Material.
Things. Yeah. Not just things, but things that weren't produced locally. Imported goods. They had stuff from Rome, stuff from Greece. What else? Something we take for granted.
Indoor plumbing.
Yeah, bathroom. A bathroom inside the house. No, nobody had that, but the rich people did.
How big
the
parking stable was underneath?
In the city, I don't know in the city that they had those. In the villages, they did, but Jerusalem wasn't an agrarian village. Yeah, not a room. How big they were?
Yeah.
All the imported goods, the fineries. You could tell. So they dig these up. They can tell. And what they found, she had a name for it. I forget what they call it. I didn't write it down. But there's an area up the hill from the temple. Or on the same hill as the temple, maybe it's not higher, but it's in that same region. And it's obviously a lot of rich people lived here. And they assume, from the kind of things they find and where it is, that these are people that are connected with the Sadducees, that are part of the ruling class of Jews. And just like, you know, you go down to Washington and you're around Capitol Hill, there's some really nice places, and they have imported stuff, and they have indoor plumbing, and, you know, whatever. We have our own rich communities in our society. Well, they did too. And those people were connected with government. It's not surprised. We shouldn't be surprised. What else did I hear? Imported goods, yeah. They cooperated with Rome. They didn't feel that foreign influence was a bad thing. Now, when you get to other lower class groups of people, they were more distrusting of the Romans and didn't like the influence. Well, the Sadducees and those that were affiliated with them didn't mind that at all. Why? Why didn't they mind that foreign influence? It gave them power and it filled their wallets. I mean, it was good for them, the way they saw it. It served their own purposes. It wasn't doing any good for the people on the bottom of the bottom rungs of the ladder, and that's so they didn't have the same opinion. According to this book by Magnus, Dr. Magnus, she and others will say that There are things in the houses that lead one to believe that it was an ostentatious display of wealth. It wasn't just they had nice things, but they loved that they had them and they showed them off. It was almost like things they wouldn't even need, just to show others that they had it. Some of it was that gaudy, I guess, considering the times. because, you know, what's gaudy, I don't know, but, you know, really fancy stuff, really things that don't have a practical use. You just have it on your mantle to show that you can afford it, that type of thing. Now, were these people interested in being different from society? No. Society served their purposes. They weren't interested in separating themselves from society. They weren't interested in being different. They tried to accommodate themselves to the Romans as much as possible because it suited their own purposes. And so they were willing to compromise for power, as Ray said, and for wealth. Now, on the other hand, you had the typical rural, agrarian, working stiff, you know, the people that worked for a living with their hands. And 90%, according to a lot of people that look up these, that study these things, you know, about 90% of the people in that world were farmers. I don't know if that includes people that fished as well, because if you're up in Galilee, they had the Sea of Galilee, so fishing was a major occupation there. But, you know, these are people that work with their hands, producing food, producing goods that the rich people get rich off of. And that's most of the people. And their goal is not to have fancy imported stuff. What's their goal? One word.
Survival.
You know, make it to next year. Have enough food. Now, they weren't dirt poor. They had houses. They might have had a few possessions, but that's all they had. And they were never more than just, you know, one bad crop from poverty. If you were in a sizable village, let's say a village like Nazareth, and you understand that people farmed out in the countryside, but they lived in the villages. All right, they didn't live, one like in America where you have a farm out and you have a house in the middle of the farm. Their houses, you're still that way in Europe. You're saying you went to France. I don't know what part of France you're in, but there are places where you see the farms that just go on forever and there's no houses there. The people live in the villages still and go out and farm. But that's the way it was back then. Excuse me. But if you had a village of a appreciable size, then you could have some specialists. There'd be enough of an economy to be able to afford, like Jesus' father Joseph was a carpenter, which doesn't necessarily mean a house builder. It might mean somebody who built furniture or whatever. So if you had a big enough village, you had some people, you know, had a carpenter. You might have had a guy that could do metal work. You know, they could do the things that you needed, and you wouldn't have to travel to another larger village. But that was a minority of people. Most of them were eking out a living on a farm one way or the other, either working for somebody else as a hired hand, or if they had some land, perhaps they were doing it themselves. Most of the time, I get the idea as I read through the histories that most people worked for somebody else. They didn't own land. You also had group, we don't want to leave them out, of the very, very poor, the poverty stricken. You know, Jesus said you always have them with you. And they did then as well. Now, which group you think did the followers of Jesus come from for the most part?
Pharisees?
Pharisees? Or which of the two groups I mean that I just described? The rich ones associated with the temple or the poor people in the countryside? Poor people in the countryside. Is there any indication from the Gospels that these are where most of his followers came from? Not all of them. He had some, you know, Joseph of Arimathea seemed to be pretty well off. He had a stone tomb, probably according to her. Now, I probably won't get into it, but not today for sure, but probably never. She talks about tombs. The tombs were family tombs. They had all kinds of different sections. It wasn't just for one body. And Joseph of Arimathea had one of those kind of tombs, so he was well off. But the average person didn't. They weren't well off. In the Gospels, and when it describes the things that Jesus did, said, and so forth, what are your hints that the average person he's talking to might have an agricultural, rural background and not be well off? All right. He attracted fishermen. He had fishermen as his disciples. He also used fishing as one of the you know, the casting a net. Right. That was one of his parables. Right. So that, how about anything else? There's a lot of them. Just think of his parables. What are the subjects of his parables? Wheat. Tares. Wheat and tares. Sowing. Reaping.
Wine.
Grape dressing. Grape. Hired hands working all day for a penny,
the Lord of the owner
property gave certain responsibilities to.
Yeah. And the way he tells the stories, it sounds to me, and I think that his audience is identifying with the workers, not with the owner. In fact, when he talks about rich people, it's usually not in a good context, is it? You have Lazarus, who's the hero of that particular parable, and the rich man, who's the scoundrel. You know, and in the next life, their roles are reversed. Okay, Jesus is always doing that. He's turned things upside down. What else? He's talking to the rich. He says, with John the Baptist, remember? He says, what did you expect to see? Somebody in soft clothes? You know, those people in soft clothes, they live in king's houses. You know, they're not one of us. All right? Jesus and his disciples didn't seem to have a whole lot of, not that Jesus had malice in his heart for anybody. I don't mean it that way. But they didn't have much use for rich people. And he said at one point, it's just harder for a rich person to be in the kingdom than for, a camel to go through a needle thread or something. Yeah. So, rich people in general are not painted in a good light by Jesus or his disciples. Oh, one time he uses one of his stories. He talks about mending an old garment. You know, he's not talking to the rich people. He's talking to people that know about darning socks. You know, not that they had socks, but that know about repairing old clothes. That's his audience. Excuse me. So the followers of Jesus, one thing about them, they weren't looking to the rich people, to the Sadducees, to the temple establishment. They weren't looking to them for leadership. They were, as Sue said, they were in general connected with the Pharisees. The Pharisees were seen as more righteous. They were dedicated to the study of the law and to keeping the law. And they were, to one degree or another, opposed to the Sadducees. And the Sadducees were seen as these people that were, as I was saying, cooperating with the Romans for the sake of their own pocketbooks, and they don't really care about us, where the Pharisees do care about us. So, in general, Jesus would be considered, by us anyway, as a Pharisee, by modern people. He was more from that Pharisaical tradition, although he, they were the ones that, they were part of the groups that wanted to see him killed. But in terms of the way he taught and the way he thought and even in his socioeconomic, he was more like a Pharisee than he was a Sadducee. So Jesus' followers, for the most part anyway, were not the elite. They weren't the rich and famous. And that's the background. I just wanted to give you some background there. The society distinctions in Israel were based on religion, not on a patron-client system. They did feel like they had to be pure, and they were allowed, for the most part, to practice their religion undisturbed, at the time of Jesus anyway, in the areas of Jerusalem and Galilee. If you want a sermon title, I know Brad will make me fill it in anyway, but I came up with one. The title is Washings, Cups, and Gnats. Got that? Washings, cups, and gnats. So now we're going to talk about washings. Not all washings. I briefly just mentioned mikveh, or mikvot in plural. Magnus, in her book, reports that they found 700 mikvot. Those are the things that you can descend in to wash yourself, to do a ritual immersion. I talked about them a few years back when I gave a series on baptism. So it wasn't an unusual thing for the Jews of that time to understand that being immersed to wash away sin. Now, they weren't washed. They weren't immersing themselves to wash away sin. They were immersing themselves to, in a symbolic way, wash away impurities. It didn't literally wash away those impurities. Sometimes the water, depending on how recently it's been changed, it might be dirtier than the problem you had before you went in it. But it was a symbolic thing that you immersed to become ritually pure, to get rid of those impurities. So the idea that they would also be immersed in order to wash away their sins wasn't something that wasn't much of a stretch for them. They could identify with that right away. A Jew could. Now, I don't know about the Gentiles, but a Jew could identify with that right away. The mikvot were, if they found 700 of them, they found a lot of them in Qumran, where the Essenes were, but they found a whole lot of them in the area of the temple and in the rich the rich neighborhood that's right near the temple, where some people had their own mikveh, not just public ones, but they had their own in their own house. So they're obviously well off. Not only did they have an indoor bathroom, but they had an indoor mikveh that was theirs. And, excuse me. They also, not only were there a lot of them found around the temple area, but they're found on the main thoroughfares. Now, why would that be? Why would you have one on the main road? Because people are coming in to worship at the temple and indeed to immerse themselves before they go in. So they'd have them on the main thoroughfares that led toward the temple. But I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about that. I did talk about it when we talked about baptism there. But I want to talk about hand washing. Hand washing. Let's go to Mark 7. You're familiar with this. Could turn to other places where it's mentioned, but we'll go to Mark 7. And if you want to, put a marker in there, because we're going to leave and come back several times. Mark chapter 7. In verse 1, said there came together to him the Pharisees, certain of the scribes, which came from Jerusalem. And when they saw some of his disciples eat bread with defiled, that is to say, with unwashed hands, they found fault. For the Pharisees and all the Jews, except they wash their hands often, don't eat, holding to the tradition of the elders. And when they came from the market, except they wash, they don't eat. And many other things there be which they have been received to hold, as the washing of cups and pots and brazen vessels, and of tables. Then the Pharisees and scribes asked him, "Why don't you walk according to the tradition of the? Why don't you and your disciples walk according to the tradition of the elders, but you eat bread with unwashed hands?" So here's the Pharisees finding fault, because their particular version of how you are to be pure involved ritual washings all the time, at least often, and especially before you ate. Where could they get that? Well, if you want to write down, why do you think that? I say, why should they? Why would they have to wash their hands in a ceremonious way? Not because their hands are dirty. This is a ritual washing. Why would they have to do that? Why would they figure they had to do that? Well, yeah, but why? Where would they get that idea? You can write it down. I won't turn there. Exodus chapter 30. And verses 17 to 21, it's talking about the priests when they go to serve in the temple. And one of the things they had in the tabernacle, this is the tabernacle, not the temple. But one of the things they had in the tabernacle and they have at the temple are different areas where there's water. And there were these lavers, these things where you dip some water out. And Aaron and his sons were told to wash their hands and wash their feet before they went in the temple or the tabernacle to serve. So the Pharisees could go back and say, look, in Exodus, it tells that they had to, before they served God, they had to wash, had to do this ritual washing. And for the Pharisees, that was good enough. That was good enough for them. If the priests had to do it, we should do it too, and you should do it too. And what did Jesus say about the Pharisees? And he said, you're binding burdens on other people that you can't bear yourself even. So they were willing to, not to say that we feel like we ought to do it, but you should do it too. And that was their approach. Now, she reports in the book here that they have found many plastered basins that appeared, and storage jars, larger storage jars for water. Some of them, now why would they think, oh, you have a basin, you can need a basin for all kinds of things, but some of them have inscriptions that say, this vessel is fit for the use of putting the sacred or the holy things in them, or devoted things in them. So they have inscriptions on them that let you know what they were. They were for rituals. All right, so we found these things. We found the ones that are plastered. I'm not going to go into it, but they've also found a lot of stone ones. And the reason that stone was preferred, if you could afford it, has to do with uncleanness on the vessel itself, which I'll explain, but not very well in a little while, because it's confusing to me too. Let me quote from this book, Stone and Dung, Oil and Spit, page 20. I read the whole book, but it's only in the beginning of the book that I'm going to be in today. See if I can read it without my glasses. The connection between hand washing and the consumption of food and drink is reflected in a debate between the houses of Hillel and Shammai. As usual, the house of Shammai takes a stricter position. What differences make Hillel and Shammai? You've probably heard about them before. Hillel and Shammai were two rabbis. They lived toward the end of, right around the time, before the time of Jesus. They were the end of B.C. and the beginning of A.D., if you want to call it that. They lived in the end of the first century before Jesus and in the beginning of the century he lived in. And they were of sufficient standing that they had groups of disciples that followed them. And they differed enough on certain things that the people that followed Hillel were called the school of Hillel, and the people that followed Shammai were the school of Shammai. And the debates between those two schools went on for hundreds of years, and maybe still going on for all I know. And if you read the Mishnah and all these Jewish commentaries, they say, well, Rabbi Hillel said this, and Rabbi Shammai said that. Typically, Shammai was more conservative than Hillel. Okay, so these two and their disciples debated about many, many things. So Shammai takes a stricter position, requiring that hands be pure before coming into contact with liquids, which can act as an agent in transmitting impurity to food and other items. So liquids can themselves be, once you make a liquid impure, then it can transmit the impurity to something else. That was the thought. The house of Shammai say, they wash their hands and then mix the cup of wine. But the house of Hillel said, they mix the cup and then wash their hands. So they disputed about things like this. They disputed about things like a lot and lots of things like that. And Jesus said, you have all these traditions. Many such things you do. And he's right. We have in the records some of the disputes of the many of these kind of things that they did. Now we're going to come back to this. But I want to move on from washings to cups because they're related. And then we'll get from cups to gnats, and then we'll tie it all up. In Mark chapter 7, I guess we're still there, right? Verse 5. Where we said that they said, why do you eat the bread with unwashed hands? He answered and said, Isaiah spoke well of you hypocrites. It's written, these people honor me with their lips, but their hearts far from me. Howbeit in vain they worship me, teaching four doctrines, the commandments of men. For laying aside the commandment of God, you hold the tradition of men, as the washing of pots and cups, and many other such things you do. And he said to them, full well, you reject the commandment of God, that you may keep your own tradition. We're going to read the rest of that later. So he talks about cups and pots. All right, they didn't criticize him about anything having to do with cups and pots. They were criticizing him and his disciples, or specifically his disciples, for eating with unwashed hands. And Jesus says, cups and pots, you're into that too. But you made it up. It's your own idea. It's not doctrines of God. So let's talk about that just a little while. What in the world is he talking about? And maybe we can get some more light. Again, I advise you to put something in there. But if you turn back to Matthew 23... Matthew brings out some of the same things in a different context, and so does Luke. But in Matthew 23, verse 25, this is already saying, woe unto you, right? Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites, for you make clean the outside of the cup and the platter, but within they are all full of extortion and excess. You blind Pharisee, cleanse first that which is within the cup and platter, that the outside may be clean also. All right, now we could just stop there, but I want to read one more. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whited sepulchres, which indeed appear beautiful outward, but are within full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Even so, you also outwardly appear righteous unto men, but within are full of hypocrisy and iniquity. Why? What's the connection between cups and pots and tombs? I wouldn't have known the answer to that exactly. But if we turn to Luke chapter 11, Luke says something, and each of these gospel writers is writing to a different audience, so sometimes they include different things they have to explain. Matthew writing to a is considered to have written to a Jewish audience, so sometimes he doesn't explain something that he assumes that the Jews would know, whereas Mark explains it or Luke explains it. Now here's Luke, Luke 11 and verse 44. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are as graves which appear not, and the men that walk over them are not aware of them. So what difference does that make? Who cares about a grave, whether or not you can tell it's a grave or not? Why does that matter? Now think about the context of what we're talking about today. How does it tie together? I'm going to let you stew for a minute there. Think about it. Why does Jesus, and why do the gospel writers in the way they write this, tie together tombs that Luke says you can't always tell they're tombs? You don't realize it's a tomb. Why does he tie that together with cups and washings? What would be the problem with a tomb that you didn't know was a tomb, maybe? What kind of a problem could that cause you? Dead body's unclean. So if you touch that tomb, you're unclean. When would that perhaps be a problem? When you're on the way to the temple, maybe for Passover.
And you step on that tomb.
And you wanted to rest, and you see rest over here, and you didn't know it was a tomb. Luke talks about that you're like a tomb, and we don't know it's a tomb. But when Matthew wrote it, he calls it a whited sepulcher, right? So what's that mean? Whitewashed. It means that you whitewash. Why would you whitewash the tomb?
So you know it's there.
You whitewash it so you know it's a tomb, and you won't sit on it or touch it or whatever on your way to Passover. Then you got to go find a mikvah and wait till sundown. And maybe tonight's Passover, so you can't wait till sundown. It'll be too late, and you have to go to the second Passover. So you don't want to get contaminated. So what did they do before Passover? They whitewashed the tombs so that the travelers, the ones that were near the road, so that the travelers would know where they were. And I've told you before, I think, probably all this group wasn't there. Years ago, when you fly to St. Lucia, we used to get connections through San Juan, Puerto Rico sometimes. And then you'd get on a puddle jumper, some little plane, that could land at the little airport called Vigi, which was in Castries, the big city on the island. Not that big, but the city. Main city. Now you have this big airport out in the middle of nowhere down in the south end of the island. But back then, you could land at this little one. And next to the airport, next to the runway, is a graveyard. But it's a typical, like, southern graveyard or whatever. You know, it's like you see in Louisiana or something. And all the tombs are above ground. And they were white or yellow, or they were bright colors. And I asked the local people, I said, what is that? And it's a tradition there. I don't know where it came from. I never have researched it. I should. before Easter, they whitewashed the tombs. So somehow or another, I guess that's carried over from, you know, the ancient tradition that the Jews had of whitewash. I assume. Where else could that come from? I don't know. But there were these brightly painted tombs. It looked like somebody just went out and painted them. They said they do that before Easter, and we were there for unleavened bread. So that's when we noticed it. So that was amazing to me. All right, so Jesus is comparing them to whitewashed tombs. And that, now you know why there were whitewashed tombs. So you wouldn't touch them, get contaminated on the way to the temple. Let's see. And again, obviously the dead bones, as Ray said, they would transmit the impurity. Let's go back to Magnus's book. This time I'm going to be on page 21, I think. All right. We're supposed to be talking about cups, but I got on tombs. So what's it have to do with cups? This isn't as obvious. Echoes of these debates. What debates? Well, you know, Jesus is talking about the outside and the inside of the cup, which is clean and which isn't, right? She says, echoes of these debates are preserved in rabbinic literature, which contains extensive discussions about whether impurity affects the insides and or outsides of vessels. These discussions include the definition of what constitutes a vessel and what parts belong to the inside or outside. Now, if you'll just indulge me for a minute, I got to read this. This is from some rabbi, or somebody writing what the rabbis say. All vessels have an outside and an inside. For example, the mattresses and the pillows and the sacks and the packing bags, the words of Rabbi Judah. And Rabbi Meyer says, whatever has hems has outer parts and an inner part. Whatever does not have hems does not have outer parts and an inner part. The table and the side table have outer parts and an inner part, the words of Rabbi Judah. Rabbi Meyer says they have no outer parts. So, you know, they argue about what's outer and inner. Why? You know, it matters. It matters. Jesus, well, I'm not going to read what we're going to read about Jesus in a minute. Here's some more stuff. A utensil whose outer parts are made unclean, its inner part is not made unclean. I want you to keep it straight. We're going to have a quiz. A utensil, the outer parts of which have been made unclean with liquids, the outer parts are unclean. Inside, its rims, hangers, and handles are clean. If its inside is made unclean, the whole is unclean. The rabbis associated hand washing with internal versus external purity. All utensils have an outer part and an inner part. They further have a part by which they are held, Rabbi Tarfon says. This distinction in the outer part applies only to a large wooden trough, Rabbi Akiba says, to cups, Rabbi Meyer says, to the unclean and the clean hand, says Rabbi Jose. And they have spoken only concerning clean hands alone. How so? Well, if one's hands are clean, then the outer parts of the cup were unclean, and one took the cup with the holding part, and he need not worry that his hands be made unclean on the outer parts of the cup. If one was drinking from a cup, and the outer parts which are unclean, then one does not worry that the liquid which is in his mouth must be unclean on the outer parts of the cup, and go and render the whole cup unclean. I didn't understand that either. But it was important, because they're worried about purity. And, you know, it could be black bumpers or not black bumpers, or cell phones or not cell phones. You know, we have our own thing today. It's the same kind of thing. They were worried about whether, you know, if the cup goes unclean on the inside, if somehow or another that would make it unclean on the outside. Well, they said, you know, and they said their approach was that it's the outside that was the determining factor. We really need to worry about the outside. And you know what Jesus' response to that was, obviously. Well, I'll read that here in a minute. They were concerned about outside purity more than inside. And it wasn't just a theoretical discussion. It actually had to do with cups and things that you drank out of and ate out of. Because it mattered whether the inside or the outside was, you know, how you got impurity transferred to you. Because if you had the wrong thing happens, you got to do a mikveh, you got to wait till sundown, whatever. You know, you got issues. Maybe you can't go to dinner that night with your friends. I don't know what all implications it had, but it messed up your life if you got impure sometimes. And I'm not picking on them. I mean, it sounds kind of funny, but you know, they mean well. They're trying to figure out how to be right before God, but they're misguided in how they're going about it. And Jesus makes the point. I think if you're still in Luke 11, in verse 37, it says, as he spoke, certain Pharisees besought him to dine with them. All right, this is Jesus. He gets an invitation. Hey, why don't you come have a meal with me? Sat down to meat, which means to eat, not necessarily had meat. And when the Pharisee saw it, he marveled that he had not first washed before dinner. Jesus didn't do the ritual washing. He didn't roll the sleeves up. If he had sleeve wipes, he didn't have sleeves. But whatever. Didn't wash up to the elbow. Whatever the rule was. And Jesus apparently noticed that. That the guy had noticed. He said, now, you Pharisees may clean the outside of the cup and the platter, but your inward part is full of ravening and wickedness. You fools, did not he that made that which is without make that which is within also? So Jesus is saying, you know, you're worried about the outside. You should worry about the inside. And this wasn't just an analogy. It wasn't just something cute that Jesus thought up. This was something they argued about. Not that Jesus argued about. He didn't involve himself in these arguments. But you notice, and I'm not going to, you know, one of the arguments, for instance, just to give you an example, Hillel and Shammai had it was the Hillel side that said you could I think. It said you could divorce a woman for anything, even if she burnt dinner. And the Shammai side said, no, you can't. You know, they argue about these things. And then remember when they asked Jesus, they said, well, this man says you can, they say you can get divorced for any reason. These people say not. They tried to draw Jesus into those disputes. And he was always smarter than they were. And he'd say something like, well, from the beginning it wasn't so. Moses gave you this, but, you know. So he'd give them an answer that, remember the answer about the taxes, you know. Whose inscription is on the coin? Render unto Caesar those that are Caesar. So he had good answers. But the point of the questions was to draw him into their arguments, and he wouldn't be drawn into it. He was always saying, look, you've got to worry about what's on your inside, and you're not worried. He was a reformer, and the leaders of the religion at his time weren't going to be reformed. All right, so Jesus said to focus on the inside. Now let's go back to Mark, if you would. I'm telling you to put a marker, and I didn't. Mark, okay. Chapter 7. Now in verse 9, he said, you reject the commandments of God, you may keep your own traditions. And then he talks about Corban, and I've explained that before, you know, that you could devote money to the temple, and then you wouldn't have to use it to take care of your parents. And Jesus said, you're just finding a way around of the fifth commandment. God tells you to take care of your parents. You devote it to the temple. Your parents die. You take the money back. Good for you. You know, you're missing the whole point of the command, and it's your own tradition, and you're not obeying God. So he explained, he throws that out at them, and they deserve to hear that because it was, you know, they had a way of getting around the law. He said, you make the word of God of none effect through your traditions, he says in verse 13. And when he called all the people unto him, verse 14, he says, listen to me, every one of you, and understand. There is nothing from outside of a man that entering into him can defile him. But the things which come out of him, they are the things that defile him. All right, now Jesus is turning this into a spiritual discussion. He's not so worried about cups and platters. He says, you know, it's what comes out of you that defiles you, not whether you touch this or that. And he says to them, are you so without understanding also? Don't you perceive that whatsoever thing is without enters into a man, it cannot defile him because it enters into the heart, but into his belly, and it comes out, you know, it comes out in the sewer and purges everything. And if you have a modern translation, it's going to say, thus he declared all foods clean. I'm going to get to that in a minute. The King James doesn't have that because the text that it's based on doesn't have that. Then he said, that which comes out of the man, that defiles the man. For from within, out of the heart of man, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lasciviousness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. These things come from within and defile the man. So Jesus is clear. You're not going to be defiled by eating with the wrong person, for instance. I didn't bring a quote. It might be in this book or it was in another book I had. One rabbi says that to eat, if you're a Pharisee, you can't eat with somebody who's not a Pharisee. You know, and that was part of that was the issue that even Paul was dealing with. We'll get into that in a different sermon. But, you know, that they have these rules that weren't Bible rules. They weren't God's rules. We don't want to eat with this person because he doesn't follow the same cleanliness laws I do. So if I sit at the same table with him and he did something that was unclean or he was with somebody else who was unclean because he doesn't care, that's going to contaminate me. And what did they criticize Jesus for? He ate with sinners and tax collectors. He ate with these people that we don't want to eat with. Now, is that because they were snobs? Well, maybe they were, maybe they weren't, but they understood their relationship with God in such a way that they felt that would make them impure. So I'll give them a little credit, you know, but it also conveniently, they were snobbish about it too. So they had a wrong attitude. And Jesus kept trying to point that out to them. You know, inside, you're like the tombs that are whitewashed. You got the dead man's bones in there. You're rotten inside. So don't worry, you know, you need to worry about the inside. And quit worrying so much about the outside. All right. He declared all foods clean. That's what your modern translations, you know, the modern texts will have that. The ones that they use, the Greek texts that they use from the modern translations have that in there. Now, I don't quote this woman as an authority necessarily. She's an archaeologist, but I think she's got some sense, just because I want to read something to you. She writes as an archaeologist, not as a theologian. All right, if you please bear with me because I want to read a bunch more than usual. According to the Gospel of Mark, Jesus not only opposed the Pharisaic innovation requiring hand washing before non-sacral meals, but he rejected biblical laws proclaiming the prohibiting the consumption of unclean food. And that's what most scholars are going to say that he did. And then she quotes what we just read from Mark 7. Then she says, "Nevertheless, it's difficult for me to believe that Jesus did not adhere to the food laws, as he seems to have followed every other biblical injunction, such as wearing seats, you know, the tassels. Furthermore, had Jesus permitted the consumption of foods that are prohibited by biblical law, such as unclean species of animals, fowl, and insects, we might expect this to be reflected in his opponent's attacks. Duh. If he was sitting down eating some pork, you know, would they have been complaining that he didn't wash his hands? This woman's got some sense, I think. Okay. Instead, they criticize Jesus' disciples for not washing their hands before meals, which Jesus rejects as a human innovation and that is not biblical law. In my opinion, Jesus was responding to the Pharisaic requirement that ordinary food be eaten in a state of purity that otherwise was required only for sacrificial food, you know, that the priest would have to do. Consequently, quote, she's quoting from somewhere here, a vessel whose outer side alone is unclean does not render ordinary food unclean. But the food is connected with the cult, then it's a holy thing. In other words, if it's, you know, sacrificed in the temple. And if so, it's made unclean by the touching the outer side of the vessel. Pharisaic observance meant that even ordinary food becomes impure through contact with the outside of an impure vessel. This is what Jesus had in mind. Is suggested by the connection between washing hands, internal and external purity, and clean versus unclean food in Mark 7. Although Jesus apparently opposed the Pharisaic requirement that ordinary food be eaten in a state of purity, I see no evidence that he rejected biblical food laws prohibiting the consumption of unclean animals and requiring temple offerings to be eaten in a state of purity. However, after Jesus' death, his sayings were understood as meaning that Jesus abolished the need to observe biblical food laws altogether. All right, she's not a theologian, she's not a but here's an archaeologist that, you know, from her just common sense point of view, says it's no evidence that Jesus ever did anything to say that you shouldn't keep the food laws. So I wanted to share that. All right, talked about washings, talked about cups. How about gnats? Leviticus 11:4, already read that, says camels are unclean. And verses 20 to 23 talk about swarming things. Leviticus 11. Verse 20. All fowls that creep going on all fours shall be an abomination to you. Yet you may eat of every living thing. You can eat grasshoppers and locusts, but not other bugs, basically. Other flying creature things which have 4 feet shall be an abomination to you. Verse 23. And these shall be unclean. Whoever touches them, a carcass of them shall be unclean till even. All right, I could read other verses, and I'm not going to. There are some verses, if you look in what the Hebrew words mean, that say that certain things, with talking about bugs and other animals too, are unclean. There are other verses that say they are impure and defiling. It could be all. I don't know. And I'm not going to, you know, it doesn't matter to me one way or the other. But because of that ambiguity, that was one of the discussions at the time of Jesus as to whether these insects were just unclean and we shouldn't eat them, or if they transmitted an impurity to you because they were a swarming insect. And they debated about that too. Okay? Page 34, my last quote from this book. This is from a document from Qumran, where the Essenes were. It's called the Damascus Document. There's all the documents have a name, and this is the Damascus document. It indicates that the Qumran sect understood Leviticus and Deuteronomy as meaning that all swarming creatures, not just the 8 species, there's one verse that lists 8 of them that are defiling, not just the 8 species are a source of impurity. from the Damascus document. It says, "Let no man pollute his soul with any living or swarming or creeping creatures by eating of them, whether it be the larva of bees or any living thing which swarms or creeps in the water." I don't need to read the rest there. So not only do you have to worry, you know, nobody's going to try to eat a gnat, but how about these bugs like gnats? I guess the gnats that they're talking about, that lay their eggs in water and the larva live in water, like a mosquito larva, right? Live in the water, little tiny thing you can't even see. And then you drink your water, or you drink your vinegar, your sour wine, and whatever, and it's got these bugs in it. Not only are they unclean, but worse than that, according to some interpretations, they transmit impurity to you. So what was the solution? What did they do? Some of them. They strained the gnat. They strained their water or their liquids. Now, there's no archaeological evidence for that because they do have some containers that have strainers on them near the Dead Sea, but the strainers are too big, like the larva would make it through. So they figured that they assumed that these things, there were so many flies around the Dead Sea that it's just to keep the flies out of the liquid. But these sieves would not be fine enough to to keep out sieve out the larva of little tiny insects. So the assumption is they would have had to use cloth or something like that. You wouldn't find in the archaeological dig. So they would strain out the gnats. And what did Jesus say? I didn't even turn there. He says, you know, he told them that they strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. Now in Aramaic, that's I can't speak Aramaic, but it's like you'll strain out a gumla and eat a kumla or something. You know, it's two words that sound almost, it's a pun, or it's a play on words in Aramaic, which is the language that they spoke. He says, you strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. Well, Leviticus says they're both unclean. But what was obviously Jesus' point? Why would he make a point of that? What's he saying? What do we mean when we say, strain a gnat and swallow a camel? Yeah, you're focused on something little and you miss the big, you know, miss the elephant in the room, miss the camel, whatever. They're both unclean. So, but you're so focused on this, you miss the big problem. That was his criticism. Okay, so talked about washings, talked about hand washings. They're worried about ritual impurity and all the things that might contaminate them, and about cups and platters and how somehow if the outside's dirty, it's going to contaminate the inside. And that the Pharisees were really worried about that. And Jesus said, you need to worry about the inside, your heart, the things that come out of you. And even gnats, you know, that are unclean. You need, you know, you can strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. All of these things that we talked about today have a background in certain disputes among the Jews and how they were going to be pure before God, how they were going to obey God. And Jesus wouldn't have anything about with the disputes. He just changed the subject, or not change the subject, but he would back away from the trees and give them a forest picture, right? Say, you know, you need to worry what's coming out of your heart. That's what's going to defile you, not whether or not you touch this or touch that, or eat a meal with somebody else who might have touched something. Okay, I warned you that I would ask, how can we apply some of these things today? What difference does it make? All right, I hopefully I've given you a little more background to understanding some of the verses, so now you know a little more about some of the things that Jesus said and why he might have said it. But what's that have to do with us today? Any application? Think of anything? Be brave, come on. All right, yeah. Don't major in the minors. That's a good one. You know, what did Jesus say about the, in Matthew 23, you know, you tie the mint and the anise and the cumin? And that was okay. Maybe you should do that, but don't miss judgment, mercy, and faith. You know, is it possible for people in our tradition to major in the minors? Can anybody give me examples? What do we tend to do? Not we, maybe in this room. Present company accepted, as my father would say. Not that he would say it in joking, like, you know, anytime you have a critical comment, the present company accepted. Doesn't apply to anybody here. But it does. You know, it does. I mean, I could think some of the things I've worried about. Any examples? Yeah, there's a guy. I try to keep up on things. There's a guy that's, I forget which branch of the Church of God was in, doesn't really make any difference, but he's in jail now because he's a pedophile. And he would read the Bible to them while he was abusing them. Now, that's an extreme example. But, you know, is it possible that we can focus, you know, we can think we can focus on God's law while we're abusing, and I don't mean that kind of abuse, but while we're mistreating our neighbor, mistreating our coworker, mistreating our, you know, families, whatever? I think so. You know, how many times, you all know examples, if you haven't been guilty of yourself, and I've been guilty of it, you know, I raised kids and put things in wrong order sometimes. You know, the church tells you this, that, and the other, and you try to do it, and sometimes you sacrifice your family for that. That's majoring into minors, I think. What I was majoring in wasn't as important as my family, and maybe some of us have been there. How about if we, I mentioned this before, and I'm not picking on our distinctives. I see this, that there's an approach among many people in my tradition, our tradition, that, all right, we keep the Sabbath, we keep the holy days, we don't eat unclean meats. That makes us God's people. We are delivered to do whatever now. In other words, we can be not loving. Now, they would never say this, but in our actions, we can put down other people, not care for our neighbor. Because we're God's people, we do these things. We keep the outside of the cup clean. So therefore, it doesn't matter. And that's what Jesus was criticizing the Pharisees for. So he wasn't saying that it was necessarily wrong to work to keep this clean or that clean. He said they missed the point of why they were doing it all together. Because they weren't nice to people. And I think in our history, we have a history of that. That we're okay with not being nice. I have been treated not nicely by people who were supposed to represent God. And you have too. And maybe we've done some of that in our history. We hope we can repent of that. But that's part of our history, I think. And Jesus said he didn't want to have any parts of that. He wanted to make it clear this is not the way my followers should be. He said, you don't rule. You don't treat other people like the Gentiles do because they want to lord it over them. You know, but the greatest among you will be a servant. So, you know, we go over to Thailand and teach the Thai and the Burmese how to serve because it's not part of their culture that the greatest among them serves. It's not really part of our culture, but it's more a part of our culture here than it is there. There, the greatest is the greatest. And we all, you know. So to teach them about the greatest among you is he who serves, that's a foreign concept. And even though they intellectually get it, sometimes in practice they don't. Because it's so much a part of them that it's another way. There's all kinds of ways we can, you know, we can be major into minors. Maybe that's the best way to just, you know, a summary of it all. We can, you know, read all the ingredients on everything we ever eat and, you know, be mean to our neighbor, whatever. Those kinds of things. Even, how about our reaction? Hopefully not us, but I try to keep up with the way the different, my friends and the fellowships that they're in and so forth. And I'm always saddened, unfortunately. You know, I listened to a sermon the other day, and they were the full counsel of God, and we got the better internet, and we got this, and we got that, and yeah, they're doing a work, but they're not doing much of a work. You know, we're always comparing. It's like we, you know, in our tradition, we're better than them. We're better. God's more pleased with us, and that's what Jesus was so perturbed with the Pharisees about. He's perturbed, I think, with the Sadducees for other reasons, but the Pharisees, they thought they were better. At least that's the way it's written up, the way it sounds in the Gospels. They might have started off with good motivation, but in the end, they were abusive. I'll just say one other thing. One of my favorite books is Starbelly Sneeches. Anybody know that book?
Yes.
Yeah, all right, good. There we go. We got some, yeah, all right.
I want to rewrite it.
You want to rewrite? Well, you wouldn't. Yeah, it's all there. You have to change a few names and it's there. That's us. Sooner as was, you know. It is so us. For those of you who don't know the book, it's these creatures, you know, it's typical Dr. Seuss creatures that are, you can't tell what they are. But some of them have stars and some of them don't. And the ones that had stars upon bars thought they were better than the ones who didn't. This Sylvester what's his name? What's the name? Yeah, but there's more to it than that. Mick who? Sylvester McMurphy McBreen or McBride McBean or whatever. McMonkey?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, he comes with this machine that can put stars on the bellies, on that don't have some. And once they do that, and all the ones that didn't have stars before now feel that they're all... They're all brothers and sisters, and we're equal now. We have stars. Then the people who didn't have the stars, the people who did have the stars originally didn't like the fact that there was no distinction now. Oh, I forgot to mention that the people who got the stars from the Sylvester, they had to pay him like $5 each time. And then the other people, they got stars, and everybody has stars now, so there's no distinction. So the ones who had the stars originally paid him $5 a piece to get the stars off. And then the other ones realized, oh, stars off are what we had to be, and they pay to get them off. And so in one of the pictures, you got a line that's just going around. It's some getting them off and some getting them on and all paying the money. And they do that until they run out of all their money. They've given it to this guy. So now you know if you didn't read the book. It's a great book. Every time I read that and Alice in Wonderland, I think of my church experience. Both of those books, they remind me of my church experience. Anyway, when I read these, like when I'm preparing the sermon, and I wrote early on in my notes as I'm doing, I say, the Sneeches. This is Jesus dealing with the Sneeches. You know, we always want to be better than somebody else. It's just natural, but it seems to be more natural in our church experience. And I hope that we've rooted that out. You know, our relationships with God, we don't need to worry about being better than somebody else. We all working for God. So, yeah, read. If you just get the book, ask your grandchild for the book. It's a good book. Read it. And it's one of those books that Dr. Seuss did not write for children. He wrote it for their parents. So next time, we'll leave the Sneeches behind. We're going to move out of Palestine. And into the diaspora. We're going to move to Alexandria, to Babylon, to Corinth, to Rome, to Sardis. All these areas where Jews lived and where Christians in the new Christian church lived. And we will explore a little bit what they had to deal with day in and day out. And it wasn't ritual washings because they lived in pagan societies, right? So they had to deal with a totally different atmosphere. And it caused its own set of problems, and it gave its own set of circumstances. And the early leaders of the church, especially Paul, had to learn how to deal with that in creative ways. So that's what we will look at next time I speak, so stay tuned.